Susan Fowler is a name people may have heard. She's an engineer who wrote a personal blog post, which she then shared on Twitter, about her experience working at the ride-sharing company Uber, and that she wrote about the sexual harassment she encountered there. This was just last month. Within 4 hours, the CEO of Uber had issued a responding tweet saying that they were launching an investigation, and Susan's tweet was retweeted more than 22,000 times. Since that day, in February, multiple leaders have been fired from Uber, and its leadership and board have had to do a major about face in their approach. One blog led to all of this impact.
I'm Megan Campbell, Manager of Research and Learning at Feedback Labs.
I'm Valerie Threlfall. I'm the principal of Threlfall Consulting and work with the Fund for Shared Insight.
Valerie has written a paper on perceptual feedback, which is made up of the perspectives, feelings, and opinions that individuals have about their experiences. Why is it important that the social sector think about perceptual feedback now?
I believe the nonprofit field has the potential to really become the antiquated relic, kind of like a rotary phone, while the rest of the world goes digital. People today are routinely accessing tools and technologies like social media that allow them to provide feedback and influence other people's behavior, really on anything, whether it be a policy decision or their work environment or products they purchase. I believe if the nonprofit sector doesn't provide similar opportunities, we have the chance of becoming quickly outdated and less relevant.
The first part of your paper defines what perceptual feedback is. Why do we need to get on the same page about that definition?
Well, as I mentioned before, Megan, people have access to all kinds of tools and are increasingly expecting that they can provide feedback that will influence change. In this Uber story that I mentioned earlier, it was an employee, but customers also have this power, and I would argue that we need clients of nonprofits to have the similar power. What kind of sector are we really building if a young person can provide feedback on her sneakers or iPod, for example, that leads to a change in product specifications, but she can't provide feedback that's taken seriously by the college access program she attends? Also, I think the feedback as field is really rapidly maturing and growing. This is evidenced by ever-growing numbers of ongoing experiments to gather and respond feedback, as well as the new tools and infrastructure that exists to support and connect practitioners' efforts, things like feedback labs. Despite this growth, what we've been lacking as a field is really consistent terminology to ground conversations and make sure that we're speaking the same language. Without consistent definitions, we're really at risk of talking past each other and diminishing our overall efforts to advance perceptual feedback as a practice. A common example is the treating of all input to be equivalent. I often get asked by people when I say that I work on constituent feedback, oh, do you mean needs assessment or human-centered design or even efforts to gather feedback from donors? These are all important, but they're distinct and should be treated as such. As we note in the paper, the lack of consistent terminology and definitions has led, and I think will continue to lead, to confusion about purpose, ideas, and what we are and are not as a field.
Something that I really like about the paper is it's full of examples. So can you tell us about a time when perceptual feedback was particularly useful compared to all the other kinds of data that someone could collect?
Yeah, sure. I was just chatting with a program actually just yesterday that provides job training using a group cohort-based model to disadvantaged youth in the Bay Area, which is where I'm based. And through their feedback efforts, they heard from youth that they feel like they become less of a priority to the case managers that they work with about 3/4 of the way through the program. And this is because at this time, the case managers are picking up that next cohort of youth. It's like the cohorts are staggered. And so they staff two at the same time, two cohorts for a while. Without hearing this input, though, and this feedback through the feedback loop that they'd set up, the organization would likely only learn of this dissatisfaction when youth stopped coming to the program and didn't make it to graduation. In this case, the feedback data really provided some accelerated insights that allowed the organization to respond, and they have responded. In other cases, I've seen that organizations may not even have consistent data or metrics about client behavior or outcomes. And gathering client feedback also provides you with a path to seeing if you're achieving your intended outcome. I would argue that any situation really where client participation or engagement is key, which is really almost everywhere, you can get value from understanding clients' lived experiences.
We often think about feedback as containing that information about client experiences, for example, and conveying that information to the service provider, to the non-for-profit who is trying to help those people. But in the paper, you actually suggest that for perceptual feedback to actually be feedback, it can't just be information that's collected. There actually has to be an intent to use the feedback to inform decision making. And what we've seen is that it's really not uncommon to see an organization collecting information, whether it's perceptual feedback or other data, only to have it sit on the shelf, not informing decisions. So that's not feedback?
I think in this case, people wish it were feedback, but I would argue it's not. If you collect information that people aren't feeling well served by your food bank, or they're telling you that your staff doesn't treat them with respect, and you do nothing with it, you've really broken the feedback cycle. Where many organizations, I think, trip up is that they view data collection as the full activity, and they really don't think about the full feedback cycle, which includes responding to data and closing the loop. And thus, they get really ambitious about data collection, but they're not realistic about the capacity requirements that they're going to have to actually implement the full feedback loop. And so, often, as you comment and note, data just sits. So I think the intent is there, but I think capacity is not realistically aligned, and therefore the feedback effort isn't resourced appropriately. What we also argue in the paper, though, is that all information, as you note, is not feedback, and that for feedback is a subset of information and represents information that is acted upon and responded to. It's what we call the purposive nature of feedback.
So you provide a taxonomy in the paper that categorizes different types of perceptual feedback. How are you hoping that people will use that taxonomy?
Yeah, I think many times people think they should only ask maybe about satisfaction, and then they don't ask about some of the specific elements and the in-process feedback that people have about how they experience a program. Or on the flip side, they'll ask about program elements, but they'll fail to ask kind of in aggregate, how does somebody feel about the service? And for example, whether they'd recommend it to somebody else with similar needs. And so with this taxonomy, I really wanted to provide a framework and a set of questions that would function like a mental model or checklist that people can go through and think about the different types of feedback that they can get from clients and think about why they're asking certain questions or not asking certain questions and be intentional about it. I also wanted to show really the diversity and range of perspectives that you can gather from clients and recognize the importance of topics such as one's relationship, a constituent's relationship with the staff of a nonprofit, and the specifics of their service experience. I don't think that everybody should ask all categories at one time, though, but asking, being intentional and thoughtful about which types of feedback you're going to be eliciting will really help you get a better picture of clients' lived experience. I know that sounds a little bit Goldilocks in terms of saying, don't ask just one, but don't ask them all, but there is, hopefully this checklist provides a workable list for folks to work through and see if they are capturing the feedback that they need.
And I think it does. Something I really like about the paper is, as you say, it gives a really clear checklist, a really clear way of thinking about feedback. It's short, it's easy to absorb. So I really encourage people to read the paper after they listen to the podcast. What's one thing that you're hoping they'll take from it?
Well, I really hope that people read it and feel like they can have a more informed conversation about the types of perspectives that they can elicit from their clients or constituents. I also would love it if practitioners would use the frameworks in the paper to challenge each other a bit. When someone talks about gathering data that's information but not feedback, call them on it and just be clear about it. And I hope that with the paper, people become more precise in how they talk about feedback using the terms and nomenclature that we provide.
So we'll see a little more challenge in the field, a little more precision, and a little more understanding maybe of what perceptual feedback is and isn't.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Valerie, for taking the time, and thank you for writing and sharing this paper with us.
Thank you, Megan.
And thank you, everyone in the audience, for listening to this first inaugural attempt at a podcast from Feedback Labs. Watch this space for more coming soon.